House Labor Committee will come to order. We have a long agenda this morning. We'll get started. We'll start with the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 518. Steve Hecker, Cheryl Hunter.
Mr. Wright Maxwith.
I've distributed some sheets that I'd like you to fill out to rate our committee administrators performance.
Right, I'll do that.
Turn those into me when you're done.
I'm shooting for the top scorer.
I think I'd give you a second on this one here.
Good morning.
This is what we need to start every meeting.
I thought it'd be a good idea.
I don't think this is
for performance.
It's probably not good for distribution, but
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Hill is the prime sponsor behind this bill, and I expect him to be here very shortly. But we will go ahead and present our testimony. Very simply, what this bill does is provide job protection to pregnant employees who may be working under hazardous or strenuous conditions due to their pregnancy or pregnancy-related conditions. And the bill would allow them to either take a transfer to a less hazardous or less strenuous job, or if they and their physician feel necessary, they would be able to take an unpaid leave.
Cheryl, Representative Johnson wanted to know if you'd given your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Cheryl Hunter. I'm Political Education Coordinator for the AFL-CIO. Excuse me. Our concern with this particular bill is that during the last 25 years, the makeup of our workforce has changed dramatically. Women now comprise 45.6% of the workforce in Oregon, and this is increasing, will continue to increase. The majority of these women work because of economic necessity. 60% of working women in March of 1987 were either single heads of households or had husbands who earned less than $15,000 per year. And according to a recent congressional report, 35% of families would fall below the poverty level if women left the workforce. We would really like to emphasize the fact that these women need the jobs that they're holding down. At the same time, they have family responsibilities, which also need to be coordinated with the jobs, and that's exactly why we bring this bill, why we have asked that this bill be introduced, in order to provide that job protection under conditions related to family responsibilities, in this case specifically pregnancy. I've explained briefly what the bill would do. This bill, Senate Bill 518, passed the Senate by a vote of 23-6, and similar legislation already exists in California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Montana. In the bill, the final determination of the hazard is left to the employee's physician, and we feel that this is very important because each pregnancy may be different in terms of what would be hazardous, and each job may be different in terms of what would be hazardous. I will leave more detailed information to Steve Hecker here from the University of Oregon Labor and Education Research Center about job hazards specifically, but I would like to say that what the bill is intended to address could be a variety of situations ranging from a short leave early in a pregnancy when a woman may be at the risk of a miscarriage during her first trimester and may just need to cut back on her hours for a very short period of time, two to three weeks perhaps at the most, and then may be able to continue in the job up to the day before she delivers. In fact, in my own particular case, that's exactly what happened to me on my job. I was able to take a cut back on my hours for a short period in the second month of my pregnancy, and then continued all the way until the day before I delivered. So that's one situation that this bill could address. On the other end of the continuum, you may have a case where a woman would have to take a leave entirely, unpaid leave, in her seventh or eighth month because of certain conditions specific to her pregnancy that would require that. And then you also would have situations where a job in itself would present a hazardous situation, such as toxic chemicals, or later on in the pregnancy, lifting, or long periods of standing, that sort of thing. In other words, there's a lot of different conditions that could exist, and that's why we feel that it's impossible to put a definition in the statute as to what the hazard may be. Finally, I would just like to say that a woman should not be required to choose between a healthy pregnancy and the job that she needs to support her family. We believe that this bill would mean healthy mothers, healthy babies, and families that would be more financially secure. I would also like to draw your attention to some testimony that I have handed out from Julia Palmert. She did testify at on the Senate side when this bill was heard, but she was unable to take time off from her job in order to come up for this hearing. She did ask me to present her written testimony. Her situation, very briefly, she works for a pulp and paper manufacturer in Eugene. She was able to get a leave from her job in which she had been painting labels on rolls of craft paper with a solvent that is phytotoxic. She was, under her union contract, she was able to take leave and switch to an office position where she would not be under any specific hazards. She also notes in her testimony that her original job was physically demanding as well as dealing with the toxic chemicals, and that even if she had not had to leave because of the chemicals, she would have had difficulty keeping up her pace to the final months of her pregnancy. And as it stands right now, she is continuing to work. I believe she's in her eighth month of pregnancy and intends to continue until the day before she delivers. In this way, she's been able to earn more money up until her leave, and she has been able to benefit from the protection that her union contract has provided. We believe that may not be true for a lot of people, particularly in marginal jobs. I think, once again, what we're addressing with this protection are those jobs where people may be working in relatively unskilled positions, may be more easily replaced, may not have the protection of a collective bargaining agreement, and could easily be given a choice of either staying on the job in a hazardous situation or being told, you'll just have to leave, we can't accommodate your needs in any other manner. And also would not be able to return if it's a situation that allows them to come back to work later on in the pregnancy. They may find themselves without a job for the duration, even though they are able to work later on in the pregnancy or during most of the pregnancy. I would be glad to address any questions of the committee.
Questions of Ms. Hunter?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hayden.
Cheryl, under the scenario you describe where you say you have an unskilled person in a marginal job, given the current state of the economy where we have essentially full employment now, statistically we have what's called full employment, and there are jobs going begging, wouldn't these people be able to return to find another job if in fact an employer said, I'm sorry, you can't come back after you've taken disability leave or pregnancy leave, you can't come back, we don't have a job for you? Wouldn't usually they be able to find another job of equal value?
Well, technically, an employer cannot discriminate against a woman due to pregnancy. However, I think that employers would be rather reluctant to take a person on as a new employee when they are visibly pregnant and intending perhaps to take leave of some kind. If only a few weeks or perhaps the 12 weeks allowed under law, I believe that it would be difficult for a person to go out looking for a job at a time like that and actually be able to compete with other people who are not pregnant. Frankly, my concern is that they are currently in a job that they have some record in, that they have already obtained and are working successfully in, and if the only reason that they are not able to continue is because of a temporary disability due to pregnancy, we feel that they should be able to have job protection in order to keep that job and not have to go searching for another one at a time like that.
another question.
Again,
with the employee that you describe who is successful and skilled at the job they have, wouldn't this employee have value with the employer, and wouldn't the employer just logically extend to them the courtesy of working with them as to the work that they could do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, we would certainly hope that employers would do that, yes. But I don't believe that we make laws for the good employers in the market. I believe that we make laws to protect people in situations where perhaps the employer is not being logical and is not taking the best interests of the employee in mind.
One further question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative.
Cheryl, I agree with you. We do make laws for that reason. And I'm wondering if we haven't been perhaps over-solicitous or over-protective in that we have really passed so many laws for the person that you described, that the scenario that you described may apply. An employee may look at a pregnant lady or possibly any lady in the childbearing years and say, I don't know, when I consider parental leave and sick leave and disability and a number of things, this may not be. Maybe we're getting to the point where we're starting to disenfranchise this category of employee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, there is a history for one thing about a law such as this providing protection for pregnant employees in order to create equal opportunity. That since only women can become pregnant. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that laws such as this, in fact, remove a barrier to equal opportunity and bring this situation back to a level playing field. In terms of not hiring women of childbearing age, if we are currently approaching a situation where women are 50% of the workforce and women of childbearing age range from perhaps 16 or 18, to beyond age 40, I believe that that would exclude a tremendous amount of the workforce, and I don't know that an employer could avoid hiring those people. And the issue of discrimination on that basis is a separate issue, and we have laws that certainly should be enforcing the fact that those people cannot be discriminated against.
Very well put. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Durkler.
Could you describe to me what might happen if an employer didn't have a less strenuous job? It says it is required to provide a less strenuous job, and there wasn't one available. What would be the step?
I believe that what would... Representative Durkler, on page 2 of the AIM Gross bill, line 3, it states, if the transfer cannot be reasonably accommodated, the employee shall be offered a leave of absence for the duration of the pregnancy or until the physician releases her to work at the former job.
Would that be up to the employer then to decide, or the employee, or?
My interpretation of that, Representative Durkler, is that if the employer feels that the transfer cannot be accommodated, which means that it would be up to the employer on that determination, then the employee would make the decision as to what course she would take. There is other language in the bill that states that the actual determination of whether a job is hazardous or not is ultimately up to the employee's physician.
Thank you.
Questions? Cheryl, I just had one. If women under a collective bargaining agreement are generally afforded these protections, why is the AFL-CIO wanting to extend this to all people?
Mr. Chair, there's a number of pieces of legislation that we work on that certainly can be bargained and is being bargained. One very good example is the minimum wage, which I think there's been a lot of discussion about in the past few weeks and will be more today, I believe. Our concern is that we work for protections for all working people. We don't just work for members of unions. I might also point out that currently, on the national level, women, only 16% of women are in organized workplaces. In other words, are represented by unions. Therefore, we have a huge number of women in the workforce that would have no means at this time of gaining those protections. And we feel that it's important enough that there be other ways of addressing the problem.
Mr. Chairman.
Sam Hayden.
Cheryl, I believe you explained to me that a physician statement would be required in the case of a claim that it was a hazardous position.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many physicians are trained in labor conditions. How would a physician know if it was hazardous or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I certainly don't know, you know, since I'm not a physician, I don't know how a physician would go about making that decision, but my guess is that through some discussion with the employee and certainly with knowledge of what is hazardous to a pregnancy, there could be a decision made by the physician as to whether the employee was working in a situation that is hazardous. It might be more appropriate for Steve Hecker to address the kinds of conditions that are hazardous and what kind of research has been done on those.
Red, Mr. Hecker.
Before Thank you.
Get, before you get started, Senator Hill, did you wish to testify this morning?
I'll wait until after these.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Hecker. I am an assistant professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon, specializing in occupational health and safety. In addition to my testimony, I have also distributed copies of a brochure put out by a Seattle organization that gives you some idea of the effects of pregnancy on a woman's body in relation to workplace exposures. I've been asked to testify concerning the hazards to reproductive health that pregnant women may be exposed to in the workplace in Oregon. The first thing that must be said about such hazards is that they represent a terribly underdeveloped area of research in occupational health. A 1985 state-of-the-art report by the U.S. Congress Office of Technology Assessment found, quote, significant gaps in information on reproductive toxicity in either experimental animals or humans for a great many industrial chemicals. The report concluded that these gaps in knowledge make estimation of human hazard difficult and prediction of human risk virtually impossible. But despite this uncertainty, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has classified disorders of reproduction as one of the 10 leading work-related diseases and injuries in its program of national strategies to combat work-related disease. This classification is reflective of the experts' view that the lack of adequate data is a reason to press forward with increased research in this area rather than a reason to assume there's no problem. Furthermore, we do have human and experimental animal evidence of hazards to reproduction for a number of chemical and physical exposures found in Oregon workplaces. I will describe these, giving some sense of the level of certainty of the evidence. And please excuse me if it gets technical. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to know, before you go into the bulk of your testimony, given the lack of knowledge that you've described in your opening statement and given my question to Cheryl, wouldn't the clinical physician without knowledge of these things, he's not a research chemist, he's not a research physician, he's not a labor physician, wouldn't he tend to err on the side of safety and say, well, I don't know, but you'd probably better stay away from that situation?
Well, I think probably most physicians would take that attitude. There are documents available. I have a document entitled Guidelines on Pregnancy and Work, which is put out by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is available to physicians in this field. I also have an article entitled Decision Making About Reproductive Hazards, which is a protocol for physicians on doing this, which is intended for those physicians who would not normally have that expertise. So,
how many physicians do you suppose have read those?
Well, I'll put it this way. Many more today than 5 or 10 years ago. I would be the first to agree with you that the general practice physician is underexposed to this kind of information.
You think 10% would be about right?
Maybe. I think it's something that needs to be further addressed. I would hope that it would be. I'd like to first briefly explain the ways in which reproductive disorders may occur. There are a range of adverse reproductive outcomes affecting women, men, and the developing fetus or child, which include infertility, impotence, menstrual disorders, spontaneous abortion, low birth weight, birth defects, congenital mental retardation, and genetic diseases. Chemical, physical, and biological agents may be classified depending upon the stage at which the agent exerts its effect. A reproductive toxicant affects reproductive function after puberty. That is, it exerts its effect on the adult through infertility, sexual dysfunction, etc. A developmental toxicant affects the growth, development, and normal organ function of the fetus or young child. Two more terms pertinent to this discussion are important. A teratogen affects the development of the fetus in utero and may manifest its effect after birth as well without necessarily harming the mother. The drug thalidomide is an example we're all familiar with. And a mutagen may harm the germ cells of the parents, that is, the sperm or the egg, or the fetus, or both. I will enumerate the reproductive hazards found in Oregon workplaces, suspect or confirmed, by individual substance or class of substance, and where appropriate, by industry or occupation. Lead is one of the best documented hazards to the reproductive process, which affects both males and females and the fetus. Industries and operations with potential lead exposure in this state include battery manufacture and reclamation, secondary metal smelting, paint and ceramic manufacture, soldering and welding, and stained glass work. Other metals have less certain but suspected reproductive effects. These include cadmium and mercury. Evidence of reproductive effects of these latter metals in humans is limited. Glycol ethers, a class of chemicals found in a wide variety of commonly used products, including paints, varnishes, and solvents, have been shown to be teratogenic in animal experiments. They're the first chemicals to be subject to regulation by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Toxic Substances Control Act, based solely on their hazards to reproduction. It is interesting to note, and I think this responds in part to one of Representative Hayden's earlier questions, that while much attention has been focused on hazards to female reproduction in industrial workplaces, which have largely male workforces, perhaps the broadest spectrum of potential reproductive hazards are found in a female-dominated industry, healthcare. Exposure to anesthetic gases has been correlated with increased rates of spontaneous abortion among operating room personnel and among dental assistants. Ethylene oxide, a sterilant gas widely used for treating heat-sensitive equipment in healthcare facilities, has been associated with increased levels of spontaneous abortion and is a suspect mutagenic agent as well as a cancer-causing agent. Fortunately, many facilities have taken steps to control exposures to both anesthetic gases and ethylene oxide, but there are still numerous examples of overexposures. Antineoplastic drugs, which are used in cancer chemotherapy, are obviously very potent in their intended effects, but some also pose serious hazards to employees who handle them. Finnish studies indicate elevated risk of fetal loss among nurses exposed to some of these agents. Chemicals used in laboratory work may have reproductive effects, so the evidence for these is more limited. Laboratory solvents like xylene and benzene, the latter a known carcinogen, are in this category. Ionizing radiation is a well-known hazard to male and female reproductive systems and to the fetus during gestation. Severe teratogenic effects are known from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki studies, but extrapolation down to the effects of low-level radiation, such as in occupational exposures, is uncertain. Finally, biological agents are a major source of reproductive hazard in the healthcare environment. Rubella, or German measles, is a well-known developmental hazard to the fetus during the first trimester. Fortunately, the rubella vaccine is effective and the potential exists to eliminate this disease. Cytomegalovirus is a herpes family virus that is of little concern to the general population but is very risky if contracted during pregnancy. Since infection may be asymptomatic, it is a disease that bears close watching in the hospital infection control programs. And finally, healthcare workers who frequently contact blood or other body fluids may be at high risk of hepatitis B. Transmission from mother to infant during or following birth is quite common, and such infants frequently become chronic carriers of hepatitis B. Leaving healthcare, another broad class of chemicals which may pose hazards to reproduction are pesticides, which are encountered by workers in agriculture, nursery work, forestry, and public works. Carbaryl, a broad-spectrum insecticide, most commonly known by its trade name 7, has not been studied well, but its action on the nervous system is similar to other chemicals which are associated with menstrual disturbances and infertility. And there is some evidence of reproductive effects from overexposure to 2,4-D, which may become contaminated with dioxin. Considerable effort has been made in the Pacific Northwest to study the suspected effects on reproduction of the widely used wood preservative pentachlorophenol. While it's well established that this substance accumulates in the fatty tissues of the body, the results of studies of adverse birth outcomes have been inconclusive. The final category is the broad and ill-defined category of physical and psychological stressors at work. It is not possible, as Cheryl mentioned, to lay out strict rules or limits for pregnant women performing potentially strenuous or stressful tasks, such as lifting, bending, or climbing. The American Medical Association has published guidelines suggesting how many weeks into pregnancy a woman may safely perform various tasks, but they are guidelines that need to be applied case by case. And it also should be remembered that while heavy repetitive lifting is clearly stressful, sitting immobile at a desk for long periods of time or standing for long periods of time creates its own set of physical stresses. Psychological stress is even less well understood, but we do know that the body's hormonal responses to psychological stressors can potentially interact with reproductive function in ways that have not been fully elucidated. To quote the Office of Technology Assessment report, the documented effects of repeated or prolonged stress on the cardiovascular, energy-producing, and immune systems should be regarded as factors with the potential to compromise reproductive function. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has called for research programs specifically to address the ergonomic needs of pregnant workers. It is important to note further that protective measures normally provided for other workplace hazards may create special burdens for women in the late stages of pregnancy. Be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions, Mr. Hecker? Thank you. Senator Hill, is he still here?
Let's go on to the next witness, Mr. Frederick.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me. Here he is. Sorry, Carl.
All right.
You got a coffee here, Mr. Chairman.
I'll tell you, I'll make you a deal.
We're friends. We can sit here together. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I really was out searching for coffee.
We know you sent
a search. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Larry Hill, District 21. I think the bill's been described fairly well for what it does. Let me just summarize rather than repeat testimony. One, this is a pro-family bill. This is a bill that removes the possibility that a woman who is working in the workforce will have to make the decision between having a healthy pregnancy or having a job. That's what it comes down to. Currently, there's nothing to prevent a woman from being fired or being forced to take time off because of threat of miscarriage. There's nothing to protect that woman's job. Now, she may have a negotiated contract, but frankly, not many women do, that protect her and the baby. What this says is that women are subject to particular circumstances. Men aren't. Pregnancy and pregnancy-related disabilities. Men aren't confronted with that. None of us are. So we don't have to face the possibility of job loss or making the choice to remain on the job with possible damage to the baby or yourself. But a woman does. And that's why the Supreme Court has said it's okay for states to provide these kinds of protections. It's not special treatment. Instead, it removes a barrier that a woman may encounter in the workplace to keeping a job because she encounters pregnancy and men don't. And she shouldn't be fired because she has complications or she has to get away from a toxic substance on the job during her pregnancy, as long as it's medically necessary. The bill provides protections provided by other states. It's based upon medical necessity. It's based upon the concept that a woman should be able to protect herself and her pregnancy from damage in the workplace. We believe it's reasonable to help women.
Hearing none, so ordered. You also have in front of you some proposed amendments from the Associated General Contractors. And did somebody wish to discuss, Representative Johnson?
Well, they're here. I guess I'd like to have someone tell the committee what they do and why they want that.
Mr. Nelson?
If it's appropriate to the bill or not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Nelson and I represent the Associated General Contractors. You should have before you a copy of the amendments that I submitted to the committee with a letter and I included the material from one of the programs that is currently being developed by the Associated General Contractors nationally for residential and commercial carpenters and brick masons. What we're suggesting in the amendments, and I think that the bill as well as the Dash 2 amendments are unclear in establishing the Apprenticeship Council in developing the certification program. It doesn't appear to us that there is a vehicle for other programs to be submitted for review, either to be approved or disapproved by the council. And the amendments that we have submitted and submitted on the 28th of April, we think creates that process or procedure. I'm not here to discuss the merits of AGC's program or other programs. They do exist, and I think that would be a benefit to the state to have the ability to for other programs to be submitted for analysis and review.
Jack, why would the Apprenticeship Council want to consider certification programs that are contrary to the apprenticeship laws? I mean, I'm familiar with your program, but all you do basically is have people take a simple test and then they can call themselves a journeyman. It's nothing at all like apprenticeship, and
I think it's a lot different from what the printed bill is trying to get at. Can you address that?
Well, I guess my response would be that if a particular program were submitted for consideration that did not meet the requirements of the law, than that particular program. One should not have been submitted for review, and if it were, really should be turned down. I guess that's really the only response I would have. There may be programs out there that meet all of the requirements of the law.
Go ahead, Representative Johnson. Your letter indicates that you, in fact, intend to try to implement a program, if I read it right, that there's some testing proposed June 17th.
Yes.
How do you, if this testing occurs, how do you expect to get these people into the workforce if it isn't an approved program?
Well, to a large degree, Representative Johnson, these are individuals that are currently involved in various programs within the state, and this particular testing procedure is one that would test in a written form the proficiency and knowledge that individuals would have in their particular trade. This particular program, as outlined in the material, has certain threshold or entrance requirements that before an individual could come in and take that test.
And it's effectively only a written test, is that right?
In this instance, what they have attempted to do is to take the knowledge areas and develop a written exam so that there is the ability to test procedures, all sorts of things relative to and I think that the assumption is that individuals have exhibited proficiency within the different trades.
Would you say is it fair to say that effectively you compete head to head with the existing programs that are operating in the state?
My assumption, Representative Johnson, is that it's not competing, but that these are individuals who are within the programs, and if they choose to come forward to take this test, this particular test is analogous to the national program of auto mechanics, for example. Where there appeared to be a void nationally, this particular program was put together to create some system whereby individuals could come and sort of put themselves up against an exam.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Nelson? Okay, we've adopted the -2 amendments to House Bill 3423.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dorfman.
Maybe you could clarify for me. It looks like what the bill does is it gives somebody a card when they complete the...
Oh, pardon me, I can't hear
you. It looks like what the bill does is give somebody a card when they complete the apprenticeship. Presently, how do you become a journeyman? Don't you have to complete a test, and aren't you given some sort of identification that you have completed the course? And
Mr. Rawbrooker is the head of apprenticeship. If you'd like, we can have him answer that question for you. Mr. Rawbrooker.
Good morning, Chair Shiprack, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Quint Rawbrooker, Director of the Apprenticeship Division. Chairmanship Rec, Representative Driftler, would you please repeat your question?
Sure. I guess when I look at the bill, what the bill does is it gives someone a card when they completed the apprenticeship. presently, when you complete apprenticeship, do you get a graduation certificate or some indication that you've completed the course and you are now a journeyman?
That is correct. You receive a completion certificate with a journey card attached. But what is contemplated with this legislation, as we had testified earlier on behalf of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, as well as members of the Apprenticeship Task Force and members of the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council, is that as we move into this new area of certification and council identifies occupations which they feel are appropriate for this enhanced certification, the journey card will represent far more than it has in the past. It will detail the work processes that the individual has successfully completed throughout their apprenticeship, as well as the successful completion of related instruction in support of that on-the-job training, so that when the journey card is issued to the individual, whenever that is shown to either a consumer or to a potential employer, that employer will know exactly what they are getting, what this individual's training has been involved with.
Any other questions, Mr. Robert? Did that answer your question, Representative Kirschbaum?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Clint. Representative Whitty?
Move the bill as amended, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Whitty moves House Bill 3423 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Quick question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix?
Is that with the dash 2 amendment?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Any further discussion?
What's going on?
Laughing gas.
Shannon, call the roll, quick.
Something happened.
Representative Dombey?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No. Votes aye.
Representative Hayden?
Aye.
Representative Manning?
Aye.
Representative Walton?
Aye.
Representative Whitty?
Aye.
Representative Dirkler?
Aye.
Chair Shiprash?
Aye. House Bill 3423 is amended, sent to floor with due pass. I'll carry the bill.
Okay, Max, let's do judge's retirement here. You got that over here.
2921.
House Bill 2921, work session.
Isn't this the bill we were looking for the other
Mr.
day?
Chair?
Representative Edmondson.
I move House Bill 2921 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Whoa. I have some amendments.
Well, we move the bill first and then we amend.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I think that's the procedure.
Representative Edmondson moves the bill. Max, you want to tell us what your amendments do?
2921-2 amendments. Do a couple things. After meeting with the PERS representative and the trial court administrator, this bill takes out the language that deals with the retirement of the judges and health insurance continuation that was a problem. It takes out that whole section. There is a fiscal impact that's been prepared, both a letter from the actuary and before you see this fiscal impact, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
This is one bill you can't vote against.
We do this for Kelly Clark.
Watch me.
$7 million. We can't take care of it. Kelly's not going to like this.
Tough.
Well, this doesn't affect federal judges. Does it? Oh.
Ways and Means will take care of it. Jeff Gilmore says. Jeff Gilmore says he's going to put all of these in the package.
The retirement age at which benefits are payable is reduced from 65 to 60. Actually, the A judge member who attains age 55 with at least 25 years of service is entitled to unreduced benefits. Final average salary is reduced from a 36-month to a 12-month. Retirement formula is changed. Surviving spouse is increased from 50% to 2/3. Those were all in the bill. What we've done is taken out all the reference to the making a new system for judges for health care cost retirement after they retire. It's a pretty healthy.
Say that again. That last
What this bill initially intended to do was to make a fund similar to the one we just fixed in ways and means that where we took money from the fund and put it into an account that was used to pay money to retirees to offset their health insurance between Medicaid and the regular insurance. And the original bill had a bunch of sections in it doing that for the judges. We took that out. And it has a healthy healthy expenditure.
Yes, it is.
If you look on your fiscal analysis provided by PERS, you'll note that the employer costs are about 29% higher, 7,275,000 in the first biennium.
Thousand?
7,275,000.
Okay.
And that is just the employer's contribution, doesn't include the employee.
That's correct. The other thing we did do is there was a section in here that allowed judges to buy, once they became judges, to buy back. And we've changed that. That's on page 8 of the printed bill. It said that these judges could buy back 10 years, up to 10 years. We changed that to say they could buy it back if they paid for their share, the employer's share, and interest.
Does anyone know whether...
Representative Johnson.
Does anyone know whether judges... retirement is currently paid by the state fully, or whether it's paid equally.
You mean whether or not they have a pickup? I'm not sure.
There's somebody who seems to know.
Anybody know that?
Mike May.
Mr. Dewey?
Amazing. For the record, my name is Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. The state pays the retirement. The cost for the fund to put the monies
fully,
aside
fully
yes.
the
7%.
The employer the employee contribution as well as the state share
yes.
is fully paid by
it's
the
fully state. Paid by the state of Oregon.
So then that figure would be double that, assuming that or does that assume that the state fully pays this?
I don't know what the assumption is.
It's in the actuary statement.
Was there a question down here?
Yeah, Max, what other category of state employee gets 4% credit per year, if any?
None to my knowledge, but we have somebody from PERS here that could answer that question.
I'd like to know.
Bob?
Morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, I'm Bob Andrews with PERS. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, in answer to your question, the formulas that we're using now are for general service people would be 1.67% for each year of service, and the police and fire are the 2%. So we do not have anybody at this juncture with a 4% rate.
So this is nearly 300% more than the general service classification.
Using your figures, yes, correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Manning.
What is the current rate that is applied to judges?
As a payroll rate, Representative Mannix, I believe you'll find that on page 3 of the actuary's report. And currently, we're looking at a rate of $24.93 less the 7% pickup. So the employer's contribution exclusive of the pickup is $17.93 at this time.
Percentage, do you have to have?
Percent of payroll covered.
Oh, okay.
Percent of payroll covered, sir. It's in the 87 valuation, first column there on the in the matrix on page 3.
If you were asking a different question, it's.
I see it on page 1 now.
Yes.
And Representative Hayden showed that to me.
Oh.
2.8125
is the current retirement
for the first 16 years.
That's correct.
It's generous.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
I would like to follow up on an earlier question that Representative Hayden had. You were asking in earlier testimony as to whether an individual that would be coming out of what we call our general service ranks, perhaps a district attorney or something, that may then go on to become a member in the judiciary, and you were asking were they to receive one or two checks. And it is a one benefit payment. It would be
folded
in together from the various types of service and what that service would represent. So it is a one payment. It's the one trust
for
our judge members.
Go ahead.
While we're on that, another thing here. As you know, I think it was the last session we passed a law that said rather than having your salary compute, your retirement benefits computed on your last 3 years, you would have it computed on the average of 3 years. The average of your highest 3 year service during your state tenure, I guess.
I'm not completely familiar with what we've done on the judges on the 87 session, but as a generalization for general service people, yes, there was a change. It came out of the 85 session,
85
sir.
Session.
Came out of the 85, where it says the average wages paid in the last 36 months of employment. The average of the wages paid in the last 36 months of employment.
No, it used to be the last 36 months, and the 85 session changed it to the average of the highest three.
High three in the calendar year, or in your employment
in your
history.
Employment history.
Or the wages in the last 36 months of employment, whichever is the greater.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm, right.
Now, this seems to change the judges to the final year. Why would they have a different calculation from you? Seems like they wouldn't.
I would have to opt there, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, to the proposers of the bill. It is just bringing it down to what would be essentially then a higher salary.
Not necessarily. Yeah, it could be a lower.
Normally the terminal salaries are the greater, but not that is not a complete pure rule. No.
Yeah, the exception being when you might have been, my example was you might have been a judge at a relatively high salary and spent your last 3 years as a legislator at $939 a month, then your last 3 years would be lower.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, I believe are the salaries as a judge.
Okay.
For that portion, sir.
Okay, I see. Okay,
I have a question
you.
For the witness.
Representative.
In regard to a provision here in these dash 2 amendments, it says the state is going to pick up the full amount of contribution to the fund required of judge members. But then in terms of computing the salary, and only for that purpose, we're going to include the state's contribution as well as the judge's regular salary, which will bump the salary also in terms of computing retirement benefits, sort of a double pickup. Does anyone else in state employment get that kind of a benefit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maddox, yes, we all enjoy that.
All of us?
Yes, that have the pickup.
Representative Johnson.
On this fiscal that we have here.
Yes, sir.
Did you participate in a review of that by chance? I just wanted to guess the question I asked.
I think he prepared it.
Okay.
Right there.
Okay.
Yes.
Given...
No pride of authorship.
Is that the entire state contribution, including salary increases or adjustments in your...
What we're presenting, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, in the employer cost is only the increase. Is only the increase.
That's both the employee...
No, that's just what the employer is. This does not contemplate an additional, where the employer is already paying the 7% on behalf of the individual. So this is just what the bill would do in increasing the cost to the employer, over and above what the employer is paying now into its own reserves and the 7%.
And that does not assume that the judges would go back to paying their portion of the contribution?
This estimate did not contemplate going back to a payroll withholding.
So effectively it would be double this figure as far as what the state cost is. It would be double this 7.5 million.
If I may take you to the actuary's letter, again on page 3, I think you will find the impact of what the 7% is. It would be just, there would be a 7% of payroll increased cost. In this particular case, if they went back to a payroll withholding, then the judge would share in the funding, so it actually would reduce the overall cost here of $5,887,000. It would reduce that because the judge, through payroll withholdings, would then fund 7% of that. As it is now, the overall cost of $5 million includes the 7% picked up by the state. Did that answer your question?
So that 5.8 then is both parts of the contribution?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman?
Deputy.
I guess I don't quite get this. I'm looking at the Mark Johnson's letter, and it shows added by 2921, 36375, and then what is this 7275 that we have in the fiscal impact statement?
It's a biennial projection.
Yeah, it's double, right?
Right, sir.
What we're actually, if you take the biennial projection and you divide it by the number of judges, 200, you get about $36,375, and that's $18,000 a year increase.
I will take your figures on that, Representative.
Okay.
Are there any other questions of this person? Okay. We'll just stand at ease for a minute or two.
I have a couple of questions for the council.
Go ahead, Representative Mannix.
If you would turn, Max, to page 2 of the bill and the provision about allowing early retirement, I see that in the proposed amendments, we're taking out a lot of that language. Are we substituting something else later?
No, this was language that was... Oh, yes, we are. Lines 17 through 28 is taken out.
Mm-hmm. It looks like we put in that.
Yes, we are taking it out, and I'm trying to remember where it's taken care of. That came out on the First Amendment from that was put in by the judge's system.
On the actuarial report, they still talk about someone who attains 55 with 25 years of service being able to get unreduced benefits, and I'm wondering where we ended up putting it back in.
Yeah, I'm trying to see.
Because I assume the dash 2 amendments are substitutes for the dash 1.
That's correct.
The reason I'm asking about this is I have some trouble with the early retirement provision.
Okay, nothing was substituted for that section, I don't believe.
So that's out?
Yes.
Takes care of that problem.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden?
Max, on the actuary's report here, second page, mm-hmm. number 7, it says that judges will will have 10 years of credit
if they're 44 or older, when they begin state employment, they'll have 10 years of credit.
They can buy up to 10 years of credit.
Any other state employee have that option?
Boy, not to my knowledge.
Let me ask a question. We need to get on here. Is there anybody that likes this bill as printed?
No.
I don't either. For 200 people, $7 million general fund fiscal impact is a little out of line.
Yeah, we got a minute.
Spend it all.
Maybe if the Republicans would go outside the spending limit, we could get this.
You'll move this as a separate issue on the floor outside.
We're not in work session.
I'm going to suggest that the proponents of House Bill 2921 go back to the drawing board. There's no sense sending this to Ways and Means at this point, and this with this type of a fiscal impact, it will never see the light of day.
Well, Mr. Chair, in view of that, I'll withdraw my motion.
I would hope so.
Thank you, Representative Minson.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
There might be some technical changes we can make in the system to make it work better, and I'd be willing to do that, but big fiscal impact stuff is another story. And I'm willing to cooperate in that, but yeah. I have some problems with the big changes here.
Well, I guess I've said enough. We'll work on it. And we'll get the proponents back together, and but they're going to have to lower the fiscal impact statement down a little bit. Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2921. Go to House 1051 looking.
We're in pretty good shape now.
Is that in good shape?
I think we're okay on that one.
Okay. Work session, Senate Bill 1051. Representative Mannix, I believe you and Representative Durfler, if I'm not mistaken, worked on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Tell us what you got?
I met with Representative Durfler, and then I had a chance to meet with Senator Hill and Mr. Fiscom from the Executive Department. The work group came up with the -A5 amendments as agreed language.
The dash what?
A5. Oh, yeah.
Here they come. I got two.
And I have conferred with Senator Hill, and he confirmed that the -A5 amendments were satisfactory. I understand Mr. Fiscom had also conferred with Senator Hill about one phrase that needed to be changed based on a comment from Legislative Council Council to the Governor. May we invite Mr. Fiscom up to mention
Dave?
That? I think it's at page 3 of the A5 at the bottom.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dave Fiscom, Executive Department. We do support the compromise that appears before you in the A5 amendments, with one suggestion for a change that relates to line 30 on page 3. And the suggestion we